Hello and welcome to another episode of the Migration and Diaspora Podcast, a show hosted by yours truly, Loxanne Harley, about all things migration and people on the move. Today we've got a fascinating episode featuring my friend Salvatore Petronella from Labour Mobility Partnerships, also known by its acronym LAMP. Salvatore is a migration governance specialist focusing on the EU external dimension, with a special focus on labour mobility and the smuggling of migrants. He is currently the Knowledge and Influence Lead at LAMP, developing proof of concepts for EU member states and engaging with industry representatives at international institutions. Salvatore previously coordinated the launch and implementation of the Migration Partnership Facility at the International Centre for Migration Policy Development. He also worked at ICF International, leading various evaluation and impact assessments, as well as serving as a senior expert to the European Migration Network. He previously worked at the European Commission, DG Home, as a seconded national expert on integration policies. I was keen to get Salvatore on the show to talk about his work at LAMP, as I'd been seeing and hearing a lot about this relatively new organisation and was curious to learn more. And because I was curious, well, I thought some of you might be curious about LAMP as well. So listen closely as Salvatore and I talk all about LAMP and their work to develop new labour mobility schemes and partnerships. We start by discussing some of the broader demographic trends that are creating a need for labour mobility partnerships. We then move on to discuss how labour mobility is currently regulated and how labour mobility partnerships of the ilk that LAMP works on have the potential to match growing labour demands and shortages around the world. As always, I'd like to thank you very much for tuning in and hope you enjoy the show. Salvatore, good morning and welcome to the Migration and Diaspora Podcast. How are you doing and where are you calling in from?
Hi, Loxanne. Nice to be here. Thank you for having me and thank you for having LAMP. I'm calling from Stockholm, where I'm based, since a couple of years, after a few years in Belgium. Well, a few years, almost 17 years, to be honest. So
you're getting ahead of the next question, which is what's your own migration and diaspora story? Because, yeah, I indeed remember when we first spoke a few years back, you were in the process of moving from Brussels to Stockholm. Yeah, give us a bit of a background as to your own background.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think I'm just one of the many EU citizens that have taken the opportunity to travel around the EU thanks to the European integration system and educational system. So I started, you know, to look for opportunities back in the years of university, moved to Finland to specialize a bit further on international relations, then back to Italy, and then opportunities started to unfold in Brussels, Belgium, natural, let's say, starting point for many of us, and stay there for many, many years. And now back in the north, let's say, with relocation to Sweden since a couple of years. So yeah, EU mobile, happy mobile citizen, I would say.
Well, are you rubbing that in because I, as a Brit, have now lost those freedom of movement privileges?
Yeah, probably. I'm teasing you there.
Yeah, well, I did manage to, as you may recall, I also lived in Brussels for a few years, so I managed to make use of my free movement and privileges before we Brexited and lost them. But you're originally from Italy, right? So when did you leave Italy? I feel that's an important part of the story as well.
Well, early 20s, twenties. Yeah. It's been a 20-year journey outside Italy, to be honest. Probably half of my life, Italy, half the other half abroad. So which makes many questions related to identity, integration, sense of belonging also raised in this kind of migration journey on a personal level. So that's something I really like to talk and read about as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And me too, of course. Okay, let's get into the topic of the day, which is about labor mobility, global labor mobility. And we're going to start with a bit of a context setter, because I think more than other organizations, your organizations, Labor Mobility Partnerships or LAMP, is really conditioned by the context that we're in and the circumstances that we find ourselves in have created that environment in which it really makes sense for LAMP to develop and explains how LAMP is going from strength to strength. So let's talk about that context and then we'll circle back to how LAMP operates in that context. Big question to get going, you know, what are these underlying global economic demographic dynamics that are driving the demand and supply for labor mobility?
Sure, Loxon, and thank you for the question. I think it's very important. It's more and more a debated topic. It hasn't been for a while. And at LAMP, at least, we've seen that vacuum as one of the main reasons to be there, because that's indeed, that's what defines our role in this migration landscape, is the fact that on one hand, you have low birth rate countries, fastly aging, both population overall and workforce population, which is a clear distinct addition to be made to the topic, and with expanding labor shortages. Actually, at LAMP, we are even passing the terminology of labor shortages to actually embrace the concept of labor scarcity, which means that we just don't have enough workers to take up the jobs that are unfilled for economies. What I mean by our economies, I'm looking at the picture from OECD countries, let's say, so the high income countries. And this is a striking contrast with what we see in so-called global south or low mid-income countries across the globe, where they have high net birth rate, mostly in certain areas. There's a high young population, high unemployment rate, but a lot of skilled workers that actually cannot access decent and available jobs. The structures are there, I would say. It's not that labor mobility is something new or need to be reinvented. It just has to be expanded exponentially. And when we put in our conversation down the numbers as they should be looked at, they're scary because the political environment is another element that defines those discussions. We're talking about millions of workers, so 400 million up to 2030, according to some estimates. It's a huge
400 million workers.
400 million new workers will be needed to keep the ratio of our growth in those economies equal.
In OECD countries.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. What is the state of labor mobility today? You know, what kind of schemes or frameworks are currently the norm?
The approaches are not one fit. They differ between countries. Some countries have a long history of labor mobility. They have tested and experimented different schemes and different approaches. As I said, the topic is becoming more and more interesting and palatable also to different actors, not only governments, but the private sector itself. It's opening more and more to embracing this idea of labor mobility. There are, of course, constraints which make it difficult. The type of approach you may take or governments take depends very much also on the sector you're looking at. So we have to bring another element in the complex metrics of labor mobility. So you have the different countries, the different economic growth pace, variation in the way the workforce population is shrinking or expanding, depending on the sectors, and also the needs of specific sectors, which may result in different kind of mobility schemes. The classic example is agriculture may need seasonal workers, so circular mobility in a cyclic way, while other sectors and industry may need more temporary, if not long-term, migration. So people that will stay and need to be retained in our markets, with also the additional question of integration. Those people will be part active, part of the society for a long time, if not for the rest of their lives. So we need to take another piece of the puzzle on and talk about also the integration. So probably I'm throwing too many concepts already, but just to give a sense of the complexity of the environment we have to navigate, but also the interest that this brings from shaping a new vision from the global agenda, I would say.
And when we talk about labor mobility schemes, frameworks, we're casting the net quite wide here. So there are, as you've alluded to, there's different schemes like circular migration schemes or temporary seasonal worker schemes. Do you have a sense of what most labor mobility is regulated through at the moment or traditionally? That is to say, is it through organized schemes or does it tend to be through kind of open work permits that people can apply for? How, I don't know if there are any generalizations you can make, especially when we talk about OECD countries or more broadly about how labor mobility is regulated currently.
Probably generalizing is really not what I'm aiming at or what we should aim at. As I said, it's very diversified and it's based on various experiences and approaches rooted also in the history of migration policies, depending on the countries. But there are some patterns, there are some similarities, there are some trends, of course, we can highlight. So if we look at the circular mobility schemes, for instance. Those are based on short-term visa, quite defined by the season of the employment opportunity, be it agriculture, be it tourism, never crossing, let's say, the range of the 6 to 9 months over a year. And many countries have those schemes with high volumes of migrants already benefiting from that. I mean, clear example, take the Spanish example of the so-called HECO program, which has been there for decades now. One of the main countries, the most beneficiary country for Spain is Morocco, and they move over 20,000 people per year. They return, they come back, they're known by the employers. You get this also trust element, which is really important when it comes to labor mobility. And over time, of course, the process, I think, has smoothened up and now is expanding. Because of the expanding shortages, Spain will need more and more workers from other countries. So Morocco will become just one of the countries, source countries for migration, and they're expanding to Latin America, opportunities with Senegal. So this is when it comes to seasonal migration, for instance. But if you look at, let's say, the more Commonwealth approach, UK or US or other countries, Anglophone countries, they tend to have more this visa specialized system. So they have different visa pathways for different categories. Now, the discussion there is on the need to expand the scope of those visa to include more categories of workers included there. This is the discussion in the UK, in the US, Australia, Canada, with different pilots. And then you have, I would say, at European level, you have the possibility to classify different permits, but we don't look at migration from a visa perspective or more from a vacancies perspective. And I will give you the example, what is called the most liberal system in Europe, which is the Swedish one, has a very low intervention from the government, let's say, and is really market driven. So employers can just facilitate the arrival of migrant workers by directly engaging with them. So the level of intervention from the government is pretty low. The level of ownership of the programs is really high from the private sector. Now, this doesn't mean that as necessarily a good practice, it's another practice. And of course, some countries, they also apply quota systems, like the one I come from. For specific sectors, you can have quota system with its pros and cons, of course. The idea that we have at LAMP is that there's not the best migration approach, but you really have to ground it in the reality of things. You know, what are the needs and the incentives to bring people into this industry? It's, you know, labor mobility is actually an industry itself, I would say.
Yeah. And when we talk about that 400 million number demand for new workers in the OECD countries, even amongst OECD countries, the characteristics and needs of the different economies and countries are quite different. So thinking about OECD countries include Colombia on the one hand and France and Germany on the other. So I was wondering if you had a sense of the types of demands that are most acute within OECD or within particular OECD countries. And we can talk about particular demands in particular countries or in specific sectors. I was wondering if you could expand on that and give us a bit more of a sense of where the needs are.
Absolutely. And thanks for the question, Loxton, because I think it's very important to bring a few elements in the discussion. One is that for many years, the focus of the international community has been on the so-called race to get talent, which means highly qualified profiles, engineers, doctors, which has raised concerns also in terms of brain drain issue from certain countries. But if we look at the reality of things today, the massive amount of labor demand that it's required from OECD countries, it's on the so-called essential worker side, as we learned to call them after the pandemic or during the pandemic. We're talking about caregivers. We're talking about nurses. We're talking about constructors. We're talking about truck drivers, logistics, those involved in the food processing systems. So really, those works that make our economy grow and go on a daily basis, those are the ones where we have the millions of vacancies unfilled. This is what's happening. And with small variations, I would say this is stable across economies. So what is in a time where we need more and more workers and legal pathways are not expanded sufficiently enough, we're going to end up in a competition between countries also for low to mid-skilled migrants. So across skill, the competition is going to be across the skills. And the countries that are investing already in that right now, I think they're going to be ahead of the race much faster. So countries like that have a more proactive approach to migration lately, or more progressive approach to migration lately, and they really integrate labor mobility as part of their economic agenda, I think they're making huge steps in the right direction. Europe, there are a few that are already leading that discussion politically and practically. Germany, Spain, again, I would say those two are quite advancing. Some others, they do things more under the radar because of political reasons as well. A few countries in Eastern Europe, like Czech Republic, has done a massive amount of reform, actually, to smooth the arrival of migrant workers. And of course, the other leading OECD economies are already part of that group of leading countries, the usual Australia, New Zealand, Canada, US, counting on the fact, and this is an advantage of language, they have the potential to tap into a larger pool of workers because many people speak English and are able to cope with the language barrier in an easier way. France, Spain, and others are now going to their former colonies to tap into their potential. Portugal, for instance, has signed a recent agreement with the Portuguese-speaking community countries. So it's a pool of 9 countries which can provide Portuguese-speaking workers bypassing the language barrier. But countries like Germany and others are investing into that, and it will be interesting to see others doing that kind of effort in the years to come.
Really interesting. And I want to also ask you a question about the seeming disconnect between that need for migrants for labor mobility in OECD countries, especially in Europe, and certain political narratives that are against taking more migrants. And I wanted to provide a bit of context by reading a short passage from a Economist article from the Economist edition of the 7th of October, in an article called, or a blog post that they have called, The Migrant Paradox. And it starts as follows. A surge of small boats is arriving on Europe's southern shores, brimming with migrants willing to work. For example, doing low-skilled jobs in construction or caring for the elderly. In entirely separate news, Europe has a mounting shortage of workers, especially in low-skilled sectors such as construction or taking care of the elderly. To some, that may suggest a solution about as complex as slotting the last piece into a jigsaw puzzle. Alas, migration is not amenable to such reasoning. So essentially, there's a very clear need for migrant workers in Europe, but also at the same time, some very strong narratives that trying to control migration or reduce migration flows, especially irregular migration flows. So I was wondering if you had any reactions or insights into why you think that disconnect exists and how we can address that disconnect.
Yeah, well, you found me in total agreement, I mean, with the passage you read. Thank you for bringing it up. My only remark that we'll see will be that this surge that the Economist is proposing is not only a surge in the last couple of years. It's been going on for decades, you know, with the peaks in different years, take 2015 or 2016. But the picture is there. It's the paradox. So it's this mismatch between what we need and what we're doing to do that. So the consequence of not giving the opportunity to satisfy the labor demand, because labor demand is the main driver of international migration. That's clear. If you don't have opportunities to fit into the labor demand equation, people will start looking for the ways somewhere else and some other ways. And this is creating the demand for migrant smuggling. So they're both systems that are demand driven. We have to address the demand. How we do that is by expanding the opportunities for people to come. And again, it doesn't mean sometimes that we have to create new pathways or new visa programs. Those exist. It's just the uptake of those visa to fill the vacancies is not sufficient enough. And this brings me to another element which we have to put as part of the equation is a lot of efforts go into the capacity building of countries to invest in. And imagine that certain countries will need suddenly a higher amount of people. Well, our consulate or diplomatic staff or institutions are not prepared to process the high volumes of visa also. So we have to take that also into account. Why this equation doesn't result in more labor mobility is because migration has become a very politicized talk. It's harder to pass messages of that may be perceived as opening the borders, as many people say, but we were talking about regulated migration, well-controlled migration. When we talk about labor mobility in the sense of a healthy industry and the one we try to push for as a labor mobility partnership, we really push for anything but control, basically. We want controlled migration, which means we know who, you know, which skills we need. So employers will tell us, well, I need those precise skills. We know which skills we may find in the source countries, and we will regulate that in a very legal and predictable way through visas. If we don't do that, then we have created basically the market for traffickers and smugglers, so taking advantage of vulnerable situations across the globe. Allow me just one example as a comparison, because I think it could be really, really telling for people listening in. Almost 2 years ago, a war has unfolded just at the EU borders, Ukraine-Russia. There was an invasion from Russia and a quick response by the European Commission and European member states to just grant temporary protection, which means that they have granted a visa for them to get in, or a status to get in, because anyway, Ukraine was already Schengen free visa. But what I'm trying to say, they gave them an opportunity to come into Europe immediately, of course, as a response to protect them, but also as a way to get them into the labor market. Well, there's been no smuggling market there. The same has happened years ago, where the borders were closed, other agreements with, let's say, bordering countries were open, and the migrant smuggling market boomed and created a profit of, I think, Europol assessed it as 65 billion euros. There you have the equation. If you open the channels and you try to bring people into the labor market, you have created the opportunities that people are demanding for and the economies are demanding for. So the equation works. So I just wanted to make this comparison because I think it's quite telling. And now 6.5 million Ukrainian, I think the latest I read from IOM, have benefited from this status. And they're also, you know, looking forward to staying in Europe or moving somewhere else in Europe, or maybe go back when the situation is stabilized. So you give the sense of mobility, which doesn't constrain people within certain borders.
Very, very well said. I'll also just read one of the final points, which I think just illustrates the challenge we are facing in Europe in terms of matching this equation, which is the end result is that Europe is nuttily deploying barbed wire fences and workers wanted banners at the same time, which I thought was quite an interesting comment. And also to just ask about, when we talk about solutions to this equation, so matching labor demand and labor supply. So why can't countries who need labor mobility, why can't they just relax their visa restrictions? Again, as you alluded to, maybe this is my sort of Anglo-centric solution, but why not just lower visa requirements, or indeed follow the Swedish model where you just allow businesses to employ migrants as and how they wish? Why is it not as simple as that?
Why it's not, I think it's a very political question that we can try to address in different ways. And it depends on different shifts also in the way it's perceived. So the reason why, for instance, we're not politically ready is also because the narrative we've used around migration, often seen and portrayed as a problem, as an issue, as a burden, but also overlooking at the fact that over time, labor migration, international migration has been quite stable, 3% over the decades. Of course, the size of it is bigger because we have more people on the globe, but the share of it has always been the same. So we're talking about 3% of global population. Part of it is international, for international protection. Part of it is for students, family reunification, so forth. So a small share, a very small share of international community is mobile and is moving. And we need to improve that. So lowering visa, lowering certain requirements, it's an approach. I think we have to do much more in the way we recognize qualifications, where many hurdles exist. We have different system. Also, if you come from a European perspective, you know, one would think once I have a title for Germany, it can be useful to go to Poland. Well, it's not the case. We still have 27 labor markets which act quite differently. So we are not there yet in terms of integrating a new response for labor mobility. There are some initiatives which are coming up, and the Commission can do as much as it can because this is national competence. But some initiatives which are projected to bring some more coordination across member states could be useful. But I think, again, some initiative that would go in the direction of creating the sense of a cyclic mobility could be very helpful, like multiple entry visa. That could be an idea. You know, just not one-off visit or opportunity, but something that you earn over time and return. You know, we were talking to some colleagues in India recently in the context of aged care, and this contact of us from India made it very clear. He said, well, we need to get in the logic of earn and return. So you earn your visa slot on a visa spot, and then you return, and then you get access to more. And then after a few years, you know, you create this trust between the governments and the countries and the industry and the employers and the employees, and then you can unlock more opportunities. So by earning this status over time, you're qualifying as a more and more mobile citizen in the specific industry. I think something in that direction could be done more, but what the foundation for that is really understanding the markets and gaining the trust. And I think more openness to labor mobility will earn the trust also between governments, because closing that discussion will make our negotiation stiff and misperception a bit higher. So I think we're going in that direction. And I think, as you rightly point, Loxon, visa is a huge tool. It's a tapping or untapping the potential of labor mobility in a way. So we have a tremendous tool there. We have to relax it sometimes.
Yeah, I think also, as you've said, politics is a big part of this. I know from my own country in the UK, we have had quite high, very relatively high net migration levels in the last couple of years. We're talking about regular migration here. And that is, of course, even after Brexit, when a lot of people expected Britain to become more controlled in its migration policies after Brexit, we've had more migrants coming to the UK. And if you look at the migrant numbers, the kind of immigration flows that are coming in the last few years, a lot of it is through temporary migration schemes, like welcoming Ukrainian refugees, welcoming, there was a large scheme involving residents, Hong Kong migrants, who were provided with a specific migration route because of the political issues with China. And then, you know, there were other schemes involving Syrian refugees, Afghani refugees, and so on. So, and what is, I think, quite established is that the British public in general want the levels of net migration to come down from where they are. But at the same time, each of those individual schemes that is bringing in the migrants is well supported. So in some ways, it part of labor mobility scheme seems to be in providing a more politically palatable way of enabling that greater matching of labor mobility demand and labor mobility supply. Or in some ways, I'm framing it there as in a more of a cynical way of political palatability, but it's also about, I suppose, public support is always important in migration. So yeah, I thought that was quite interesting to point out. And before we get on, I really want to get on to more about how LAMP works and how it started and so on. But just as a last point, I want to also play devil's advocate here. So a couple of counterpoints to the notion of, oh, we just need to match labor demand, labor mobility demand and labor mobility supply. A couple of counterpoints could be as follows. So one could be, why should we not try and create opportunities in the countries of origin, in the global south, or however you want to put it, so that labor supply can be matched to labor demand in their own countries? And the second point would be, if we are trying to address demographic imbalances by bringing labor supply, excess labor supply in the global south to excess labor demand in the global north, is that not just pushing the challenge to the next generation? Because, you know, obviously the migrants, labor migrants will come, they will be of working age, and then they will eventually age, and then you'll need to replace them. So do we want a situation where we have just the global south is there to feed the labor demands of the global north? Anyway, just a couple of devil's advocate counterpoints that I would love to hear your thoughts on.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Loxon. And if I may just react or add to what you said earlier on the UK, from the UK perspective, I think for many years, too many discussions around migration have had overlapping elements, confusing the issue of migrant smuggling with international protection, the friction between the systems, the asylum system, the potential of labor migration, or also confluting, you know, imbuing this discussion basically into a bigger foggy pot around international migration. It's been a bit of a mistake. We have to take different approaches. Of course, mixed flows exist. Of course, we also have to provide opportunities for refugees into the labor market as soon as possible and not just letting them wait for many, many, many months before their processing files are done. But just to say that I think, and it's still quite surprising if you look again at the economic context we set before and the demographic context we set before, it's still striking that labor mobility is not up in the agenda of the international community as much as other issues, which we related to a much smaller fraction of international population. So I think we need more momentum there. We need to work together with governments, with civil society, with migrant associations, with industry associations to push that narrative up. As you said, also, it may sound cynical. I agree. I confront myself sometimes with that judgment sometimes. But economic terms around labor mobility are what matters. And they talk very clearly to governments, audiences, and industries. And it's also not an element that migrant workers refuse themselves. They're all looking for economic opportunities. So I think we shouldn't shy away from that discussion, but we should embrace it and make part of our economic arguments for growth and recovery. Also for opportunities for the global South. Now, going to your two points. I know some of the concerns around labor mobility are always around the so-called brain drain. What happens, and this has been explained by sufficient research, is that so-called the migration spiral. Once you start earning more in terms of GDP, your migration outlook expands, which means that if you're that poor, you cannot even move. But if you start to become a bit richer, your opportunity may lead you to migration. And that's okay, because those people will bring remittances, will bring skills, and will try to reinvest the earnings in terms of human and financial capital back into the countries. When it comes to brain drain, of course, there have been issues in certain sectors which developed countries have not dealt with in the most ethical way. But there are models in building migration policies and design that can help avoid those. And for instance, here, maybe I can develop now or maybe later on providing some elements of something we are trying to build a lamp. But there are migration schemes which can easily focus on this and try to prevent the so-called brain drain. And then whether we are tapping into the expanding potential of the global South to just feed our needs, it may look like that. We have to be careful the way we frame those situations. And as I said, if we just look also in terms of individual impact of labor mobility compared to what ODA, Overseas Development Aid, gives to each individual, we're talking about a tremendous difference. So we believe that labor mobility is a much faster, much stronger development tool that provides economic income, higher potential in the future, better skills, and also more agency to the migrants themselves. They can decide better about the future. So we see a tremendous opportunity there that it's not been framed well enough, I think. So us as experts, government representative, international community, we have to be better at communicating this the right way. And I hope answered your questions.
Yeah, no, it's very good to have your point of view on those things. Let's talk more about LAMP then, and tell us about how it started and where it is and its mission.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm really happy to talk about LAMP. I mean, I've been working in the migration field for many years now, but I think what LAMP tries to do, it's really timely and it's really important. So I'm really happy to be part of this small family. So we're a small organization established in the US, but we are a so-called remote organization. So no offices, I would say, with a global outreach. So we are placed now in four different continents. It's a small team of diverse experts from economists, financial specialists, political scientists like me and others. And we just work, as I said, we believe that labor mobility can be one of the best and the most impactful tool to alleviate poverty globally. Our goal is to actually give more decent economic opportunities and prospects to millions of people through labor mobility. So labor mobility is the tool to alleviate poverty, to bring people out of poverty. And the equation was there. I mean, we mentioned it before. And that's what we try to do in a short way. LAMP is relatively young also as an organization, only a few years. But we believe that to change policies, we need good practices. and those that have to demonstrate the potential. That's why we take a really pragmatic approach to what we do. We try to enter the nitty-gritty of migration design and migration policies. So we try to see where are the constraints, the hurdles, the obstacles, the incentives, the winning elements for each one involved. And we try to take a really comprehensive approach to it, of course. Multi-stakeholders, the right stakeholders. We try to really take a private sector-oriented approach, a sectorial approach, because, as I said before, different migration policies may please better different industry sectors. We really try to do this in a comprehensive way.
Seems like a really fascinating organization. And one reason why I reached out is because I keep seeing LAMP in different forums and on different platforms. So really wanted to get a sense of what you're about. And so tell us a bit more about how you work with your clients or with how you work on these different labor mobility schemes or partnerships. What kind of schemes have you been working on? You said you work with different sectors and so on. So does that imply you're working not only with national governments, but also with industry associations or trade unions, or I don't know, perhaps you could just give us a sense of the types of schemes you've been working on and the types of labor mobility partnerships you've been working on, the types of organizations you've been serving.
Yeah, no, absolutely. As I said, our approach is comprehensive. It can vary depending on the needs and the tasks we're required to fulfill, let's say, in a specific corridor. So we may talk about specific precise intervention to understand what are the hurdles that doesn't make an existing visa pathway work. There might be binding constraints, there might be excessive fees, there might be the presence of unethical recruiters. It varies. It depends on the analysis we do on the ground. So that's really the understanding of the problems. I would say it's one of the things that we really try to work on a lot. Then is the design phase where we think, okay, this might be a good prospect for this government and for this industry to pursue. And we do that in a very collaborative space together with governments, employment agencies, industry association. Also, we try to work as much as possible with migrant workers themselves. We try to be, and how can I say, to amplify their voices through our work. In terms of schemes, they're, as I said, they're pretty different. There's one in particular that we're trying to test and understand more. It's also because it's, you may have read it a bit everywhere. You know, everyone is talking about Global Skills Partnership. Some others like IOM folks talk about skills migration partnerships. I think probably we're talking about the same thing. We were talking about something that is really globally oriented, migrant workers respecting and engaging the industry. These kind of schemes, they also have, I think, the advantage to tackle from the very beginning the issue of potential brain drain risks. And the way it works is basically that you're trying to create a pool of skilled migrants in the sending countries, which can serve both the sending country economy and the receiving country industries by providing a smoother way, unlocking the visa and filling labor shortages. As we said, with, of course, the higher income gains that this brings from the mobile population, but also in terms of industry growth in the source country. So it's, as many other people painted, as the triple win situation. You know, it's winning for both governments and for the migrants themselves. But I would say it's winning for the industry because you're creating the culture of labor mobility within the industry. And for instance, here I'm shifting probably on the industry side. We are trying to work, and we work more and more in the care industry. We're part of the Global Aging Network. We cooperate with the European sister network, European Aging Network. And what we've seen has been an interesting process because the industry, although they recognize the needs of more workers, or at least they recognize the shortages, they've been always very skeptical around migration. Because of the cost of it sometimes, because of the reputation of certain experiences, because of abuses that have happened in the most, think about domestic workers there. And as the Economist article was saying, a lot of people are ready to take caregiving jobs, but without even a legal framework attached to it. The care industry, let's say, has been a bit burned by the experience of unethical or irresponsible labor mobility. That we can fix that with what I said before, well-controlled and responsible labor mobility industry. In other words, it's a couple of years we've been engaged in discussions. We can see that this is picking up. Some governments and some association of representing different countries are coming to us to work together in the design phase and try to see how this can help them reduce the risks, financially speaking, let's say, or the administrative burden, but also make sure that they are sure that there's no exploitative situations or, as I said, brain drain issues arising, and that migrant workers are bringing the skills that are needed. Again, language can be one of the barriers we look at as well. And we're trying to do that in a smart way, including financial solutions attached to that.
A couple of follow-up questions that come to mind. One is just a quick side point. So you mentioned these global skills partnerships, and that is a concept, if I understand correctly, pioneered by the Center for Global Development in the US. And am I right in understanding that the founder or the genesis of LAMP came from those who are working on global skills partnerships within the Center for Global Development?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the genesis of LAMP is within CGD. It's been incubated for a certain amount of time until the point we became an independent organization. And of course, I mean, the narrative and the research has influenced the vision of LAMP, but GSPs are one of the migration approach you can apply. We will be happy to apply this. We'll be happy to see its potential at play, but it's not the only one. For us, GSP in this specific industry, in the care industry, is really good, but maybe not the best one in other sectors. It wouldn't work in a seasonal worker perspective, probably, that you have like multiple entry visa and other programs which can work much faster and much better than GSPs. GSPs are also heavy to build, I think. We have to understand that building the trust, building the infrastructures to sustain that mobility scheme is quite heavy. And this may be one of the scary points, let's say, for governments to invest in such a scheme. That's why we're still piloted and there are not many existing globally, but we'll be happy to test and, of course, share results whenever available. Yeah.
Be very curious to know about how those go. And we're going to have to close this interview soon, unfortunately, as I'd very much like to continue speaking with you about this very interesting topic. But before you leave, I wanted to ask you for any of your big learnings that you've had from working on these different labor mobility schemes and frameworks with LAMP. And in particular, what are the kind of common issues or challenges, big problems or defects that you see currently in labor mobility schemes or organized labor mobility around the world?
Yeah, thank you, Loxon. And I mean, I share your feeling. It's been a pleasure to be here and we could discuss for much more time. But by the way LAMP works, we enter very, very detailed discussion. So I think the learnings are very much technical sometimes. Things that are surfacing that no one had looked at or no one had considered, but they've been part of the puzzle and been a bit hidden, let's say. So there are a lot of learnings which we hope we can unveil more and more with better communication also from our side and by presenting our work in different sectors. But more on a higher level, I would say, for me, still striking the fact that we have this global context clearly spelled out. We have economic gains on both sides. The loss in economic gains of non-enough labor mobility has been $1.3 billion, IOM has said lately. So, I mean, those are huge numbers in terms of economic potential for both OECD and other countries. What we learned and we keep learning is it's such a complicated topic also to sell or to present. It's very politicized. It touches sometimes not only some economic, of course, arguments, but it touches really sensitive chords of who we are, what kind of society we want to build. How is my society going to look in 20 to 30 years? And those are questions of more sentimental level, but they're really embedded in any migration design. So I think we have to be ready also to face those kind of discussions in a very clear and warm way, in a way, if you allow me. So try to debunk stereotypes around migration or take away that unnecessary political layer that we have there. And on the other hand, I mean, what we learn is that we have many, many industry employers, actors, migrant workers association ready to work on this. And they can't wait to just embark on this labor mobility journey. It's just that the constraints are still quite high. Many obstacles exist and we need to work on the decision makers many times. So we need to try to influence more governments and create coalitions, including the industry. It's necessary that they're on board of any of this kind of discussion. One of the things that I learned I'll close here probably last week in a conference in Madrid, but I haven't really learned, it was just reconfirmed, is that the pace of the needs of the industry, both employers and employee side, is much faster than the pace by which governments react to labor mobility needs. And that's the biggest mismatch. We need people now, they need opportunities now, but governments are still in this very slow pace approach, which is understandable. There's a lot of obstacles. So, you know, it's a big administrative machine, but we should see labor mobility more in a smoother way to try to minimize that mismatch, temporal mismatch, let's say, between the needs and the reaction to that.
I think it's a very thoughtful point to end on. Salvatore, it's been a pleasure having you. Thank you so much for your time. Very last point, just how can listeners connect and learn more about you and LAMP?
Oh, absolutely. We have our own webpage, of course, lampforum.org. We are posting through our newsletter. You can subscribe to that on the website and as well through LinkedIn posts. We're quite active presenting some learning from missions or work that we do. And of course, from time to time, we also part of publications or studies so we can find some evidence from our work on the ground. Thank you so much, Loxan, for having me and LAMP at this podcast.
Thank you very much again. Links to all of that and more in the show notes. Best of luck for 2024. There's a lot of work ahead for you to do, and I look forward to hearing more about LAMP's work in the coming years. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Migration and Diaspora podcast, powered by Homelands Advisory, your independent migration and diaspora agency. If you've enjoyed the show and would like to support our channel, please feel free to share it or leave a review via your preferred podcasting platform. You can access the channel's full archive and show notes by visiting homelandsadvisory.com/podcast, where you can also get in touch if you'd like to be on the show. Thank you again, and see you next time.